listening. I don't know, he said. He looked nervous. I don't think so. Then he turned to B. Do you want to fuck her? Hell yeah, said B. Let's do this. I had huge pupils, cotton mouth, hairy legs, greasy hair. A and B had called the way I walked the Thorazine Shuffle, laughing. Living Dead Girl was a nickname they'd assigned me, a stolen lyric from another song. I followed B up the carpeted stairs, past the meds window, which was closed and locked between meds times, and into a little bathroom. He switched on the lights. I hadn't contemplated the literal meaning of the word fuck until he began unzipping his skater boy jeans. Fuck meant his cock, short and thick, already hard, was going to be inside my body. It wouldn't be at all like the last time I'd fucked, which had been with my boyfriend who was so sweet and always worried about me and had made me a mix CD for the hospital. This time, fuck meant pain. My pussy was as dry as my mouth. The matter of choice did not occur to me. I was so numb. I was on the ceiling. The Beatles' Here Comes the Sun, one of the songs on the mix CD my boyfriend had sent with me, played in my head. B sat down cross-legged on the bathroom floor and I knelt beside him. He took my face in his hands, lowered it down, and I choked. The song's sweet melody filled my mind. I tried not to breathe through my nose. My heartbeat was so slow. Living Dead Girl. Spit on it, said B. I can't, I said. The meds, I had no saliva. Okay, get on top, he said. I was looking for a word, but it was so far away, locked in an ancient memory. A health class in junior high school, the aisle of a drugstore, behind the counter of a bodega. Condom. I remembered it as I said it. B sighed, pulled a wallet from his pocket, and removed a Trojan. He tore the blue wrapper, which was worn soft around the edges, and showed some tears. The latex inside was brittle and split when he tried to roll it on. At least he hadn't refused. I got on top. I coached myself through every movement. Up, down, up, down. Here Comes the Sun was building toward the chorus. B moaned, grabbed my hair, pulled my ear to his lips. I've got AIDS, he said, in a soft, rough voice. And then those reassuring lyrics arrived. My time in the sunlight was almost here. He came inside me, stood and zipped up, left me to clean myself. I thought, what a trick we had pulled, what a miracle not to have been caught. The chorus's vocals came to an end, and then that pretty riff. Over the next 2 days, underneath all the blur of medication, fear piled up in me. It started low in my stomach and gradually stacked up to my throat. I don't remember anything about that period, other than the feeling of choking. Then B was discharged from the hospital. As soon as he was gone, I went to the meds nurse, who was young and had a kind voice. I had sex with him, I said, and he has AIDS. She looked horrified. She made me repeat myself. She asked me where I'd done it and when, and I told her the answers. Did you use a condom, she asked. She was wringing her hands. I noticed she was engaged. The diamond on her ring glittered so many colors. Too many colors. The brilliance of it stirred panic in me, the first sharp feeling I'd had in weeks. Sort of, I said. I tried to explain, but she was frustrated. I worried B might get in trouble. What is sort of? She sounded frantic. I thought, she hates me. I tried to use one, I said. It was the truth. I really had tried. HIV test, STD test, pregnancy test. Calls to my parents, who showed up. We all met with my doctor, who said that the circumstances transcended matters of confidentiality, and he had examined B's medical records. He is HIV negative, he said. My mother wept with relief, and my father wrapped his arm around her. All eyes turned to me. I felt required to display an emotion, but all I felt was fuzz filling up my skull, like the filter of a clothes dryer accumulating lint cycle after cycle. "You are not at risk," said the doctor. "You are HIV negative, but that does not reduce the seriousness of what you've done. Do you understand?" I nodded. "We're going to need you to sign a contract." I nodded. I'd already signed one promising not to cut myself. Signing my name, I could do that. "And you will reflect on your behavior and the tremendous danger you put yourself in," he added, "and the suffering you have caused to the people who care about you." I looked at my parents and they looked away. Their faces showed disgust and anger and fear most of all, as though looking at me might provoke me, might incite me, like I was a dangerous animal. There were plenty of kids, those less fortunate than I, whose parents wouldn't have cared less. My parents left the hospital. I was given a pencil, a legal pad, and a list of questions. Why had I acted out sexually? What consequences could I have experienced? What consequences did my actions have for other people? What patterns of promiscuity do I see in my life? What drives me to be promiscuous? After answering these questions, I was to write a contract stating that I would no longer engage in sexual behavior at the hospital and sign it. I held the pad and pencil in my hand as a frowning social worker led me to the quiet room. It was a tiny square room where the floors and walls were padded with blue plastic mats, the door locked from the outside. I might have been overwhelmed by claustrophobia in there, but mercifully, the door had a small, square window. The lock to the quiet room clicked shut. I sat down and stared at the questions. I put the pad and pencil down on the mat and lay on my back. Above me, two fluorescent lights flickered. I closed my eyes, but I could still see the flickering inside my eyelids. I had no idea how to answer the questions. They seemed to be written in a foreign language. They seemed to pertain to someone else. They seemed like riddles. Fuck that. The purpose of the quiet room, as explained to me by a nurse when I had first been admitted, was to give patients a safe space to calm down if they needed it. I was calm. Most of the patients saw the quiet room as punishment. I did feel punished, but that was fine. The mat I lay on smelled like Lysol. I rolled my body up against the door so I couldn't be seen through the window. I was invisible. I was alone. Nobody could touch me. The room was absolutely silent. Finally, so was I.
63 Days by A.J. McKenna. It has been 63 days since I stopped making excuses for you, since I stopped telling this exclusively as a story about my gender dysphoria, since I shifted my focus from the fact that you stopped when I screamed to the fact that you started at all. 63 days. What does it say about me that I wish I could go back? Not to before it happened, though of course I wish for that, but I have gotten used to compromise, to settling for less. I would settle for going back to the way I felt 64 days ago. I feel weak for saying this, but I would. I know the strong thing to say is that it is better to admit what it was than to hide from it completely, the way I did for 13 years. To say that I am facing up to it at last and that this is a good thing. But I am not strong, and honestly, I resent having to face up to it. I resent having to be a survivor. Survivor is the special needs of victimhood. If I say I have survived, I'm fooling nobody. I didn't. My friends, Those who have seen me change over the past 5 years, seen my body alter from the effects of hormones, and seen me get better at doing my makeup and appearing more confident in how I walk through the world, call me fierce. And I hate the word, partly because it's such a stupid drag queen cliche, but also because I know just how much it is a lie. There was nothing fierce about the way I screamed in that room 13 years ago when you refused to listen to me telling you I didn't want your lips around the part of me that I hate to name. There was nothing fierce in my unresponsiveness or in the way I held on to the fact that you did finally stop when I screamed as proof that you hadn't assaulted me. There was nothing fierce in the way I broke down for the first time 63 days ago. 6 days ago, on the train, I read an article about men who fetishize women with penises. I closed my eyes against the memory, and when I came to, 3/4 of an hour had passed, and although I had not slept, and had not dreamed, and had not meditated, I could not tell you what my thoughts had been in all that time besides the one. You made me an object. I was not a person to you in that moment. I was at best a challenge, an unresponsive organ, a stubborn body. 12 years and 6 months ago, the first girlfriend I had after what you did told me she liked my solid presence in her bed, and this made me feel sad because I never thought of myself as the strong one. It was always her who had been strong, who had made me feel safe from the moment at the end of her party when she asked me, "May I kiss you inappropriately?" And I asked her why it would be inappropriate, and she said something about her age and the disparity of social capital between us, and how asking it might seem like she'd invited me over just to get off with me, and I said that I wouldn't think it inappropriate at all. And she kissed me, and we slid to the floor of her flat and coiled around each other like the figures in a Francis Bacon triptych for what seemed like hours. I was no more physically responsive to her than I was to you, not the way you demanded. She did not see this as a challenge. She did the things you didn't think of doing. She ran her fingers up and down my back. She touched my hair. She kissed me, bit my nipples, ignored the part of me I hate to name. And when we were done, when we had explored enough and the vodka her Russian friends had brought began to catch up with us, she kissed me goodnight and went to bed alone. I didn't have to sleep beside her the way I had with you after you stopped. After you told me I could please myself and turned away. Yes, I slept beside you afterward. Another entry in the case for the defense. Like the fact that I asked you, to start with, made a fool of myself saying how attracted I was to you, how much I liked you, how much it would mean for you to be my first. Well, I was right about that. It meant a lot. Still does. How would I explain, in court, that I spent the whole time terrified of what I'd have to do? That I worked so hard to get you off without the part I hate to name because I didn't want to be reminded what they said my body was, how safe I felt when your skin flushed and you threw your head back from just the touch of my fingers and I thought, thank God, I won't have to. How could I tell a jury how frightened I was when you said, okay, now you? She didn't make me better, the one who came after you, but because I loved her, I found ways around the pain, around the memory, ways to penetrate that felt, to me, like being entered. I never told her that was what I was doing. I never told her what you did. I was pretending what you did was not what you had done, that it said more about me than it did about you. That you stopping when I had to scream was kindness. That was how I described it when I told the woman I would marry, who I would live with for 6 years. 6 years of finding ways around the problem, which I did, because I loved her. How much of the problem is my gender dysphoria, and how much of it is the result of the trauma you inflicted? I sometimes wonder if you could ever understand what you did. How your lips and your fingers, the anger in your eyes, made what should have been a pleasure ground a contaminated sight? I don't know. I didn't, until 63 days ago. 41 days ago, I took a transgender man I know to a hotel I was reviewing. We talked over crab and pork belly, about friends we knew who were poly, about the couples I'm a secondary to and how I feel this suits me. Over cocktails in the bar, we talked about relationship anarchy. Over wine in the hotel room, as we leaned out of our balcony window, I turned to him and asked him, clumsily, if it would be okay if I kissed him. And he told me he had wanted to kiss me for ages. And we kissed, drunk and stoned, clumsily, and found our way to the bed, and it didn't solve anything. In the morning, he seemed distant and impatient to get home, and I wondered if this was because I hadn't shared as much as he had in that bed, because he let me touch the parts of him I would have had a problem naming, while I kept my briefs on the whole time. Since 63 days ago, there is no way around the problem for me. When someone touches it, the part of me I hate to name, I do not see my former wife. I do not recall the way the woman who came after you touched me. I remember how you grabbed me, how you told me that you wouldn't normally do this and opened your mouth and your anger and incomprehension when I screamed. 64 days ago, I would have found a way around that. I believe in relationship anarchy because of what you did to me, because of what Donald Winnicott called cathexis. To cathect is to invest emotionally, libidinally, in hope of reward. Because of what you did, I cannot do this, because it is how you treated me, as someone who would reward you by responding the same way as the man you were used to. When I tell people this, I never know if I am making sense. All I know is that I cannot treat the people I love as things I take from, that I can see sex only as a process of surrender. But there are parts of me I hoard, parts of me I will not give away, nor sell at any price, because you tried to steal them. 28 days ago, at a party at my apartment, I kissed a trans woman I barely knew, and she kissed me better than anyone has in my life, better than the woman who came after you, better than my wife, and this may have been because I was on Molly, but the way she touched my back was heavenly and she solved nothing. I still fall asleep, feeling broken. I still come to with no memory of where the past hour has gone when I read or see something that makes me remember. I still see no way I can live with this. I still wish it was 64 days ago. 2 hours ago, halfway through writing this, I bought a dime bag of weed for the first time since I was a student. I asked my housemate what hours her dealer kept, and she went out to score. I've done a lot of drugs I haven't done before in these 63 days. MDMA and speed and laughing gas. And a lot I've done before. Poppers, weed, and booze. Oh, so much booze. And that solves nothing either, but I don't expect it to. I expect it to help me to sleep. I've been taking codeine, too. I say it's for the headaches. I have done my research. I have scrolled down the list of porn clips that come up when you type the words lesbian and rape into Google. I have read about the women in the Congo who collude in, sometimes lead, the rape of captives. I have read the interviews with Justine Chang and Armand Kay, who made the documentary She Stole My Voice about rape in lesbian communities, but haven't managed to bring myself to watch the film. I have read the articles that give the statistics, that explain why even these are inadequate. I have talked to women who've been shouted down for talking about violence in queer women's relationships, with trans women who've been raped by cisgender women at gunpoint. I have listened to one of my best friends tell me she is beginning to think she is just the kind of person this stuff happens to, and I have told her she is not, that what happened to her says nothing about her, and I have felt like a hypocrite because I do not believe the same thing about myself. I screamed and begged for you to stop, but I almost wish that you had hit me, had blackened my eyes or knocked out a few teeth, because it would mean that I fought back instead of begging. I have looked for counseling and given up on that, 2 days ago, I walked into my doctor's surgery to talk about my anemia, and I fully intended to tell her about you and ask for some kind of referral, or even just something to help me sleep, some legal drug that I would almost never mix with any of the others. But she said, "You don't look your usual self," when I walked through the door, and I lost my nerve. I told her about the cough I've had the past few days, how I'm worried that I might have pneumonia again. And when she told me to stand so she could listen to my chest, I panicked and asked how much of my clothes I'd have to take off, whether I could stop at my shirt or would have to take off my vest too, felt embarrassed about the suspenders that held up my jeans. I have been butching up more when I go outside these last few days. I used to do it for long journeys, but now I feel I need to do it just to go to town. I wouldn't say it makes me feel strong exactly, but it makes good camouflage. I know this, too, won't solve anything. If writing about you was going to make everything right, then I'd be right by now. In the past 64 days, I've barely written about anything other than you. I've written blogs and poems, half of a one-woman show, tweets at 3 a.m. that I deleted when I woke up at 7. You have become my cottage industry, and although I hate the thought of that, I sat at my desk with my mobile phone propped against my aging webcamless laptop and told you, wherever you are, that sometimes I call you my rapist. And that feels wrong, somehow. But I cannot keep saying the woman who raped me every time I mention you and cannot say your name because I only know your first name anyway. And in saying even that, I turn accuser and am too aware how easily my case could be undone. An accuser who'd been drinking when it happened. An accuser who'd consented at the start. An accuser who, at the time, was presenting as male. An accuser who'd be bound to fail in court. So I, out of need for variation, name you mine, my rapist. It feels wrong, too intimate somehow, suggests collusion, a joint enterprise between us. It takes two, they say. Two, babe. Me, you. It smacks of going steady and those creepy 50s love songs. Every night I hope and pray this fear will go away. But I cannot say your name, and the woman who raped me sounds clunky and anyway is legally someone who can't exist. English law defines rape as an act committed only by the male. It's sexual assault when women do it. As if the two are easily distinguished. But the woman who sexually assaulted me is clunkier still than the woman the law calls impossible. So sometimes you are my rapist. And I wonder if, in some sense, that is true. Was I the only one? You seemed surprised that I said no. Was it shock that spurred you on as much as malice? Or instead of it? And do I want that? Does it make you better or me special? If it was only the once. It doesn't matter if I'm one or one of many. I may call you my rapist, but we know that isn't true. Whatever law or rumor says, whoever else there was, you were never mine. You were the rapist I ran into. And I thought, this is the one that solves it. But it didn't. Nothing ever does. For the past 63 days, I have tried to solve this, with drugs, with lovers, with words. And nothing has done it yet, and I am beginning to think nothing will. It's 27 minutes past 6 as I type this. If I can stay up a little over 5 hours, I can say it's been 64 days. And I will wish it was 65 days ago.
Only the Lonely by Lisa Meekham. The women and I drew numbers and took turns fetching gifts from under the Christmas tree, opening them one by one, showing all what we'd unwrapped. I was thrilled to be invited to this holiday gathering, joining the PTO president, the head of the women's auxiliary, all the movers and shakers on the home front of this rural, sophisticated Connecticut town. My husband, two children, and I had just moved to Weston earlier that summer, so to be included felt good. I was one of the last to go, and when it came to my turn, I chose a small square package, unwrapping it to reveal a silky scarf. Everyone sighed longingly as I held it up between outstretched arms. I feigned excitement as the gift made me anxious. I'd seen others wear scarves like this draped casually, so effortlessly across their shoulders. I wasn't even sure I had anything to wear with it. The last woman to go grabbed her gift from under the tree, and the room exploded with laughter as she unwrapped it and held it high among the plush-covered chairs and gold-framed art for all to see. A giant purple dick. The party was called a Yankee Swap, and it was held in the meticulously decorated living room of a woman whose husband was a Wall Street banker. To participate, we'd each been instructed to bring a wrapped present, a funny gag gift or serious luxury item, or anything in between. At this point, we were all three white wine glasses to the wind, but still it surprised me how much I was drawn to the vibrator, how I felt this overwhelming impulse to rescue it from public shaming. So before the laughter subsided, I stood up and grabbed the vibrator out of the woman's hand. I have a friend who would love this, I said. The room went dead. And this would look so much better on you. In a grand comedic gesture, I threw the delicate scarf up in the air so it would flutter down upon the woman's lap, but it missed and slumped to the floor. Odd glances, weak smiles, dinner was served. Up until that moment, I'd never held a vibrator in my hand and had rarely seen one in action. Once, in college, I'd walked in on some guys in my boyfriend's fraternity communally watching porn. Seven guys in a darkened room, scattered on chairs and couches and the floor, staring at the hot glare of the television screen where an overly hairy guy said, "Come on, baby, you know you love it, baby," while he jammed a dildo as long as his forearm into the asshole of a woman bent over a table. Her moan low, interspersed with piercing cries that did not sound like pleasure. But at the holiday party, amid all its contained civilization, the vibrator felt like the most powerful object in the room. After dinner, the women gathered in yet another part of the grand home and poured more wine. I was ready to leave, still embarrassed by my unexpected snatch of this gift. So I excused myself, lamenting the fact that I had no purse, no place to stow the vibrator. Laughter followed me as I left the room. "Hope your friend enjoys that." I flipped on the light in the darkened kitchen and saw one of the husbands standing there, leaning against the counter. I knew him a bit, had talked to him when stuck in the corner at a school function. He was an important man. You could tell this by the way the other men deferred to him. A money guy. A hedge fund guy. He was drinking, etched glass in hand, filled with an inch of golden liquor. I stopped in my tracks, surprised to see him. There'd been no shout of, "Honey, I'm home." He didn't say anything. The room was still save for the motion of his wrist swirling, swirling, swirling the drink around. A muted shriek of laughter. The women far away on the other side of the house. "Fun party?" he asked. He brought the drink to his lips and swallowed it, greedily, in one gulp. eyes on mine. "Oh, yeah," I said. "Look what I picked." I held up the vibrator. He walked toward me, blocking my path around the counter. My nose tingled from all that liquor on his breath. He put the glass down and raised his hand to my collarbone, exposed by the fancy top I'd bought to wear to the party. Dragging his finger from one shoulder across my throat to the other, "I want to lick you." His face inches from mine, charged air where our mouths might meet. My body's wired response to being wanted by a man so sure of his place in the world. Like all those boys, watching the woman bent over the table, her face screwed up in the pain of performance, tongues darting around their mouths. I moved past him to the pile of coats on the table, searching for mine as I felt him approach from behind. I wanted to shout, "Get someone else in the room," but this man, he was power. And me? I was the new girl in town who'd snatched a sex toy out of another woman's hand. Instead, I turned to face him, placing the packaged device between my thighs, pressing them together, holding it there, while I put one arm through my coat, then the other. I pulled the vibrator from between my legs and turned to leave. "Be careful," he hissed. "If you use that too much, your clit will go numb." But I was out the back door, fumbling through the dark, across the expansive property, to the long gravel driveway, to the safety of my car. At home, I stashed the vibrator way in the back of my underwear drawer. In Connecticut, I had long stretches of the day to myself. The school bus would come at dawn to pick up my daughters, and my husband always left early for his long commute to work. It didn't feel right, liberating the vibrator from the drawer in the harsh morning light, but that's what I did, the first Monday after I'd plucked it out of the hands of the woman at the party. I extricated it from the complicated plastic wrapping. It was bright purple, with sparkles, about 6 inches long. I had no idea if this was considered a normal-sized vibrator, but it was certainly less intimidating than the one I'd seen in the porn long ago. I inserted two batteries and turned it on to the first setting. A slight pulsing. Next setting, more. On the final setting, the vibrator gave off a sound like my neighbor mowing his lawn. I dropped it on the floor and watched it buzz its way under my bed. What was I doing? All of this ludicrous. Purple, my younger daughter's favorite color. The drone of it under my bed reminded me of all those women laughing at me at the party. I wrestled my way under the bed. Balls of dust and fluff clung to the vibrator's shaft like stubborn pubic hair. I turned it off and thrust it back into my drawer again. Months later, spring. Bus came. Husband left for work. There were school functions and the random dinner party, but I couldn't decipher the terms of female friendship in this town. Solitude is one thing, but this was a particular kind of lonely. The kind you don't expect when you've checked off the boxes of living a lucky life. All smiles at events, but then no follow-through. Maybe, I thought, my middle-class Midwestern roots were showing. I was an imposter without the financial assets to dilly-dally in elite country clubs and vacation homes. I was weeding old clothes out of my drawers when I found the vibrator. Still purple, still sparkly, I turned it on. The batteries still worked. I removed my clothes and lay on the bed. The breeze from the open window was sharp, and my nipples grew hard. Alone in the house, I imagined my husband, how we used to make love. How he'd say, so gently, "You can come again. I know you can." And he'd give me that gift. And now, how I couldn't stand to kiss him. He tasted like copper in my mouth. Intimacy replaced by something far more desperate. He'd been staying up late, unable to sleep. His speech, fast and hard, like a train with no destination. It scared me. Instead of sex, I'd pull off his pants. How he'd be so hard, which always surprised me because we'd done nothing to get to that point. He was always ready. How he'd put his hand on my head and move me. I contributed nothing but an open cavity. As I rubbed my nipple lightly with a finger, pleasure rippled through my body, a feeling I'd not had in months. I turned the vibrator on and spread my legs. But it was awkward. I didn't know whether to put it in me or on me. All I felt was a deadening throb. Your clit will go numb. That hairy man behind, the dildo jamming again and again into the woman's gaping hole. I turned the vibrator off. In the wake of its buzz, an aching silence. It was so quiet in Connecticut. Cars rarely passed our house. No sidewalks. Trees competing for open sky. I closed my eyes and laid the vibrator on my belly, crossing my hands over it. It's hard to tell people when something is wrong. Hard to whisper out loud that your husband might be going crazy. Because maybe it's not him, it's you. The woman married to the bright young doctor, the woman with two beautiful daughters and 2 acres of land and 2 cars. The woman at the party who grabbed the vibrator. I came out the front door wrapped in my bathrobe, vibrator in hand. In front of our house, a doe stood, head raised to the branches of a laurel tree, pulling off leathery leaves with her teeth. She skittered off as I made my way into the yard. It felt good to be outdoors. How desperately I longed for the seasons to turn. Animals, plants, the land, they demanded nothing from me. For once, I was glad our house was set back from the road, surrounded by a dense cover of trees. No one could see me out here. I turned my back on our worn-out house, the stage of my failure, and walked to the far edge of our property marked with a stone wall. On hands and knees, I parted the dead leaves, clawed at the soil with the vibrator's purple tip. The surface was harder than I thought, not yet thawed from the harsh winter, so I stabbed it repeatedly against the earth until the ground broke into chunks, triggering the instrument on. My digging fingers finished the dirty work. When the hole was deep enough, I dropped it in. That implement. For the lonely, unwanted. I mashed dirt, leaves, sticks, whatever I could find, until all that was left was the muffled hum of a buried thing. I sat back against the wall, and my breath turned to gulps. The fresh smell of turned soil in my throat. And my hands, my hands. I wrapped them around my shins and pulled in tight and cried and thought about how when you're hurt, way before you say it, you have to feel it. How wounded animals in the woods look for a quiet place. How they stay without moving for days.
What I Told Myself by Vanessa Martir. I don't remember who told me what happened to my mother, but I think part of me has always known. I knew when she beat me until I was a shivering ball in a corner. I knew when she held a knife to me that time I was 5, pleading to her partner Millie, "Dare me, and I'll kill this little bitch." She stabbed me repeatedly, not hard enough to break skin, but hard enough that it hurt, hard enough to terrify me, hard enough to make me think that she really wanted to kill me, hard enough to let me know that something had happened to her, and she never got over it. I was 19, a student at Columbia University, in love with a drug dealer from Washington Heights. I found out that night that he cheated on me for the umpteenth time, and I didn't want him to touch me, but he still did. I told myself it wasn't rape because we were in a relationship. It wasn't rape because I still loved him. It wasn't rape because I didn't fight him off. It wasn't rape because I stayed with him after. It didn't matter that I kept whispering, "No, no, no." It didn't matter that I sobbed the entire time. At least I wasn't raped like Mom was, I told myself. The first time it happened to me, I was 6. He was Millie's uncle, Val. I was up in the plum tree of the backyard we shared. I had learned how to climb it the summer before and still had the scars on my legs and scuffs on my sneakers to prove it. I'd go up in that tree whenever I wanted to get away from my mother's cruelty. Up there, I could imagine a different life, one where my mother loved me. I heard him call my name from his window. When I peeked through the leaves, he was dangling a bag, which he pushed into the sunlight so that I could see it. "I got some turrón for you." I recognized the bag. It was the same pistachio and almond nougat that Millie got for me when we visited the carnivals that went up overnight in the abandoned lots that dotted Bushwick in that era. I wanted that nougat bad. I looked over at our window, where I could make out Mom's bloated belly. We found out later that year that she had cervical cancer. She cooked in the kitchen. I could smell dinner, fried chicken with tostones and garlic pounded to a sticky pulp in Mom's straight from the island Bilong. She was too busy cooking to pay attention to what I was doing. I climbed down and went into Val's apartment, even though I knew I wasn't supposed to. Mom had lectured my sister and me about staying away from men, though she never explained why. I learned why that day, when Val did what he did to my 6-year-old body in his living room, which was an altar to all things Puerto Rico. I left my mother's house at 13, and I never moved back. I had to save my own life. I know now that she couldn't mother me, still can't, because of what happened to her. I don't know the details, but I do know this. My mother was raped by her mother's husband when she was just 16 years old. She hadn't been in this country for 6 months. She still had Honduran soil under her fingernails. My brother was conceived in that rape my mother was blamed for. No one really ever talked about it. That evening, after Val hurt me, I sat in the tub thinking about what happened. It was my fault. I'd gone over to him willingly. Now I understood why Mom had lectured us about wearing shorts underneath our skirts and dresses, buttoning our blouses all the way up, sitting with our legs crossed. Now I understood why Mom beat me that time I lingered on Tio Damián's lap, ignoring her dagger eyes. She had caught me that night in the shower and lashed me hard with a thick leather belt. "The next time I see you in la falda de un hombre, I'm gonna break your face." I lay in the tub and let the hot water run until it singed my skin. I wish Mom had saved me the need to learn the why for myself. I wish she'd told me about what some men do, and I wish I'd listened. I knew that I was dirty and disobedient, and I deserved to be punished. I started scratching my inner thigh and inched them slowly. I clawed until I bled. Then I cried quietly into my bloody hands. Each time I peed, the sting reminded me of my crime. I mutilated myself for months after that. Even after Valentin moved back to Puerto Rico, I never got close enough for him to touch me again. There was another time. I was assaulted on a Brooklyn street when I was visiting my mother, just down the block from where she still lives. I didn't want to tell her what happened, but I couldn't get myself together before I saw her. My shirt was ripped. My hair was a mess. My fists were red and swollen. I had his skin underneath my nails. She heard me sobbing in the hallway and came out running. ¿Qué te pasó? She yelled. I was 24. This ain't shit compared to what she'd been through. On a summer day when my daughter was 6, I went to the playground with a friend so that my daughter could play while we talked. And as happens often with women, we started talking about the things that girls endure. When she confessed that she was molested, I nodded and said, "Me too." I watched as my daughter ran across the jungle gym and started grappling across the monkey bars. She hadn't been able to do it just a few months before. She'd sulked as she watched other kids and gotten mad when I had tried to help. "Let me do it myself," she said, pushing my hands off. She made it a few rungs in and fell. She climbed up, tried again, and fell. I saw her tear up and wipe her eyes roughly. She spent the better part of the afternoon working on getting across those bars. When I asked her about it as we were leaving, she said, "I'm gonna do it, Mommy. Watch." Sure enough, all these months later, her hands were calloused, but she could grapple across those rungs. She waved at me when she reached the other side. "Look, Mommy, I did it." We gave her a thumbs up and kept talking. "How old were you when it happened?" my friend said. "I was little," I said. "I was 6. "Vasia's age?" "Yeah." I looked over at my daughter, who had moved on to the swings, and that's when it hit me. I'd been blaming myself for 30 years for what happened to me when I was just 6. When Millie was on her deathbed, I told her what Val had done to me. I was 30 then, and my daughter was just a few months old. Millie looked at me with a solemn expression and said, "You can never tell your mother that." That was also the day Millie confirmed to me that my mother's suffering was worse than mine. She'd been raped. Me? It wasn't that bad. "I'm mutilated," I blurted out to my friend in the park. I scratched myself until I bled. I immediately regretted it. A long silence followed. Then she whispered, "I thought I was the only one who did that." My daughter is now a month shy of 13, the age I was when I left my mother's house. I'm well into my 40s. My mother is not in our lives. I can't remember the last time I saw her, but her story still haunts me. I won't lie and say I've completely convinced myself that what Val did to me and what my ex did to me and what that man on the street did to me were as bad as what happened to my mother. And maybe I never will. This I do know. It was bad enough.
Stasis by Ally Sheedy. I was 18 years old when I went to Hollywood to begin my acting career, after growing up in New York City and being raised in great part by feminists. My mother, Charlotte, took me to small grassroots meetings that eventually evolved into the women's liberation movement of the 1970s. And I had listened to arguments about the framework of the Equal Rights Amendment, gone on marches, and attended consciousness-raising sessions. In one session designed for the kids, a woman demonstrated how her walk changed when she put on high heels. What I clearly remember is someone saying, "If I'm wearing those heels, I can't run away." Hollywood was, to put it mildly, a shock. On one of my first auditions, a director told me he liked me but could not possibly cast me because there was a beach scene. Apparently, my thighs and ass were going to get in the way of my fledgling career. I was 5'7" and weighed about 130 pounds. It did not matter that I did a good job on auditions, that I was smart, that I had natural ability. My thighs were the thing. So I dieted. All the time. I learned that whatever I might contribute to a role through talent would be instantly marginalized by my physical appearance. I learned that my success would be dependent on what the men in charge thought about my face and my body. Everything I had learned back home had to go out the window as I adapted to these new requirements. What I looked like was paramount. It wasn't even just whether I was pretty or thin. It was that I wasn't sexy. When I managed to land my first part in a big movie, I was given a thigh master as a welcome present and told to squeeze it between my legs at least 100 times a day. A director of photography told me he couldn't shoot me looking like that when I walked on set one day. He said it in front of the whole crew. I was too wide, I guess, in the skirt they had given me to wear. A few years later, I was told point blank that my career was moving slowly because nobody wants to fuck you. There was something about me sexually that wasn't selling. It was a challenge for me starting out, but it seems almost impossible for young women now. I do volunteer work in film and theater with teenage students at a public school in New York. The kids are gifted, and in my junior class, we recently completed a performance of Shakespeare scenes for the rest of the theater department. I asked four 16-year-old actors with real acting chops and courage what they'd experienced trying to make the leap to professional work. Kai, Michelle, Layla, and Joe. Kai, who played Lady Macbeth, told me she was 13 when she first got a call from an agent, and they told her father to leave the room. Then they asked me how tall I was, and for my weight, and that I should put my weight on my resume, she said. They asked me for my cup size. They told me to turn around, and then told me, work on your sex appeal. At 15, she was asked if she would feel comfortable humping a table in the audition room, and her mother was asked if she would be comfortable with Kai working in only a bra and panties. She explained that she's now sent to auditions in the slut category and was told to diet down to a size 4 because her agent would not re-sign her contract if she were above that size. So, Kai said, she understands that body size comes first. It doesn't matter that she can handle Lady Macbeth at 16 because she will be playing thin and overly sexualized characters if she wants to get work. Layla, who chose to play Iago in a scene from Othello, also told me that casting people have been typing her. It's my boob size, butt size, skin tone. I get cast as the hairdresser and not the pretty sorority girl. Michelle, who played Lady Anne in Richard III and also sings, overheard a director saying, I was so distracted by her boobs I couldn't hear her voice after an audition. For some roles, she said, I'm too busty, I'm too curvy. And it's not just in the acting world. I was in class and a teacher kept staring at me and staring, Michelle told me. He kept bringing up his wife to me. Then I left class and my friends told me he said, man, I wish I was still in high school about me. I reported it and nothing happened. Even teachers will see you in that light. These are gifted adolescent women who don't get to be judged on their impressive talent. Their bodies are already paramount to the work they want to do, and it's only going to get worse. At 16, these students are being judged on their sexual attractiveness. Their talent is a gift, but it is not enough. As Michelle says, we are told to use what you have to work with. Boobs, ass. Joe, who played Paulina in A Winter's Tale, said, I don't care how talented you are, it's your look. Kai says, what is the look? What can I be? What should I have? Apparently, the look is now a super thin stomach area, big breasts, big butt, gorgeous face, and a freed nipple. When they first told me about the nipple thing, I tried to understand, but it was clear that it was not the burn the bra mentality with which I was raised. These young women must be comfortable without a bra and with visible nipples under a thin shirt as part of a perfect breast. Big enough to be sexual, but not so big that it's slutty. Meanwhile, a director recently told Kai, I don't see the innocence. I'm so close to giving up on everything, she said. These girls say that there is an unattainable image that men have set for them in their professional lives, and that the men subscribing to this image have been raised to think this way. Layla explained, laws can't be changed. It's psychological attitude. It's not being fixed. It gets worse. People think it's being fixed. It's not fixed. It can't be fixed. I realize I am privileged. I am white and work in the film and television industry. I've had great opportunities, worked hard for them, and done the most I could do with them. But I also made the conscious decision to not market myself in a sexual way, and it cost me. It is very, very hard to create a career as an actor without sexualizing oneself. I have been navigating this minefield for over 30 years with varying degrees of success. I've spoken out about the sexism in my industry before and faced backlash. I've been called bitter and told my behavior was cringeworthy. Whatever. There were things I could just not bring myself to do. The film by the great director that would require me to shoot a scene in a shirt but no panties, for example. He was making some kind of statement, I suppose. I rejected the advice to date men that could possibly advance my career. I didn't go on auditions for films that I felt glorified sex work, that depicted women being sexually abused in a gratuitous way, or that required me to leave my sense of self on the doorstep. All of these films became huge hits. But this is the way women are set up in the media. There has been some movement, I suppose, but not much. It's a frustrating and demoralizing struggle with some moments of triumph in spite of itself. And I still love acting. I still love a good role more than just about anything. Why is the female physical appearance so important in the arts? Sean Penn is the most gifted actor of my generation, and I don't think he's gotten Botox. I don't think Bryan Cranston had butt implants. What is a woman to do? Turn on the TV and you get a good look at rape culture. I have tried to make a career without contributing to it. I'm still trying. It used to be when I was younger that there was the bombshell role and the role of the less attractive friend. At my age, it's a little different. There is one major female role available for every 5 roles available to men my age. There's the mother role and maybe something a bit more than that. One of my favorite TV roles a couple of years back was that of a rather ruthless lawyer described in the script as 40s, brilliant, and thin. Sometimes the characters I play or could play are described as still attractive in spite of their age, because women my age aren't usually attractive, or so Hollywood seems to think. The best characters I get to play are the complicated, dark, kind of crazy ones. I love those characters because I can just do my job and not deal with whether or not some producer finds me sexy or reasonably attractive for my age. But I've had to search for those kinds of roles. My kid has asked me why I love playing deranged characters. The quick answer is no makeup, followed by no men. From feminist teach-ins at Columbia and Barnard as a student, to Hollywood and beyond as an artist, to teaching young actors in a prestigious public school, I can see the fight for women's equality remains. I can look at myself in the mirror without shame, but with endless bills to pay, because I circumvented the exploitation rampant in my industry somehow. But what do I tell my students? How can I tell them to not accept that their success is dependent on their physicality, but also that they may be contributing to the same stereotypes that hold them back? The issues women are facing in the film and television industry are not just about fair pay for famous, rich, white actresses. I find it shameful when my super wealthy peers complain about being paid only $400,000, though it is, indeed, helpful to illustrate the wage gap between men and women in the industry. It's more important to tackle the absence of a platform for young women who are extremely talented, but who are not thin, blonde, white, and/or deemed sexually desirable by the powers that be. It's more important to tackle the frustrating status quo, where the powers that be are still male and take up disproportional space in the audition room and the boardroom. We have to end the system where it is only white men who decide when a woman, in any position, privileged or not, is deserving of power and agency. I'm still navigating the sexual appearance standard in professional work. When I'm called to consider a role or audition for a role in TV Hollywood land, my talent is never in question. The studio or the network wants me on tape to see what I look like now. I was never alone in a hotel room with Harvey Weinstein, but I've been at dinners that felt like come-ons, and I've walked into rooms where I've been sized up and then received phone calls or date requests that I've turned down. Today, if the producer or executive or male director in charge finds me sexually attractive, then I'm on the list. This is how it goes. This is how it is. If the Harvey Weinstein disaster illustrates anything